This week's patron-exclusive episode on Etrian Odyssey is available for all Patreon subscribers at the $5 per month or higher level. Enjoy this preview and enjoy the full episode by going to patreon.com/retronauts, where you'll gain access to this episode, plus many others, and even more patron-exclusive content. That's patreon.com/retronauts.
Listening to that podcast over and over because I burned old podcasts to CDs when podcasts were under 90 minutes long in a fabled time. And it was one of the ones I listened to over and over, which probably brainwashed me into wanting to buy a Etrian Odyssey. So good job, both of you.
Right on.
I would posit that, you know, this game, even though it has such deep roots in a PC style, could not have worked on anything but a DS.
I agree. And I 3DS. And I think that
yeah, where was our Wii U version?
But that system flopped hard and Atlus said no. Mm. But yeah, that does kind of raise the question of what's going to happen to Etrian Odyssey from now on, because there's just not really a platform that it works for. I guess it could maybe sort of work on Switch, but it's just not the same. I mean, using the stylus is a really big part of the Etrian Odyssey experience, and using like finger-based touch control, it wouldn't be the same.
The correct answer
experience.
Is to get a stylus and the flip grip and then turn it over, and there you go.
That's a lot to ask of people to play an esoteric kind of niche RPG.
I mean, yeah. I think
I'm in favor, but
I think what you do is you pack a stylus in, and maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves, but if you hold like the L2 button, maybe it can like bring up the map and then you can kind of like sketch out where you are and everything. But yeah. It's not the same. No. Yeah, so there's definitely going to be compromises, but I hope this isn't the end of Etrian.
It's just like Mario Maker too, where it kind of functions, but it can't be the same.
Yeah.
But I think the other thing too that makes it one of those games that was perfect for the DS was just how good the DS was as a RPG machine. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, I would say, arguably just as good as the PC at the time.
Yeah, I mean, Switch has really taken up that mantle of being like the ultimate RPG system. So, you know, there is that sort of like, I want them to make it work, but I just don't know how it could work and be as satisfying. But I've got my fingers crossed. I feel like, you know, maybe let the series lay fallow for a few years and then bring it back. There's always room for a good dungeon RPG. And Etrian Odyssey sort of brought back the genre. And what I quickly learned is that most dungeon RPGs are actually not that good, and they're very frustrating and obtuse. And a big part of what made Etrian Odyssey good was that it's very straightforward. It's not like super, you know, tutorial-ish. It gives you some very light direction when you first start out, and it kind of just like leaves you to do your own thing. But it's not, you know, a lot of dungeon RPGs really stick slavishly to wizardry, and so you get a 6-character party, and you know, you're going to end up with like 3 characters who have to be in the back row and can't actually strike enemies. So you go out and like for the first 3 hours you're playing, only half your party is effective and the other is just like sitting there as dead weight in the back row. Etrian Odyssey never does that. It allows you to build a team that is pretty useful right from the beginning. And, you know, you'll change your team makeup as you go through the game and need different strategies and have just different requirements in the dungeon. But I never feel like with any of the Etrian Odyssey games, and I've played all of them except the most recent one, Nexus, that it's wasting my time, that part of my party is useless. In fact, the designers gave you a 5-character party instead of 6 because they want you to feel like you can't actually account for every possible contingency in the dungeon. They want you to feel like there's always just this gap in your party makeup that you can't be able to go out with confidence and say, I'm just going to steamroll everything, because there's going to be some situation out there where, you know, that 6th party member would have been essential and perfect, but you don't have them, so it's going to be challenging.
And and that took me a little time to figure out, because coming from the Wizardry and Might and Magic Bard's Tale games, usually your composition is 6, and, you know, sometimes you'd summon a monster or have a monster join you, would be enough, and you didn't have to experiment with party makeups. In this game, you have to. And it took me a while before I finally grasped that and started making different party.
Yeah, and the more recent Etrian Odysseys, they do give you options to have characters where you can summon monsters or undead or whatever. And, you know, that does kind of balance things out a lot. But the very first one especially is meant to be a challenging game, and it's meant to always leave you sort of off balance and always feeling like, you know, every foray into the dungeon is a risk. It's a, you know, there's a downside that comes with it, and you have to play carefully and smartly. And be sure to take your wires, your Ariadne's threads, because if you don't, you're going to be screwed. And watch out for the squirrels, because they steal your Ariadne thread.
That was one of the drawbacks of Persona Q, which was after a certain point, I felt like I had a party that could basically roll through everything. Mm. And that was in part because the shadow magic was so powerful. And it was like, okay, well, I got my perfect party makeup. I'm done. And then that's why I ultimately quit, because as much as I was liking it, I didn't feel like I was had anywhere in particular to grow to at that point.
You know, one of the great things about having this multiple party system that you want to work on is it not only does it ask you to experiment with the different characters and the different builds, but it brings about a whole different play styles as you go to the dungeon. You know, sometimes you just have a group whose only job is to harvest and go out and get resources. And sometimes you'll have another group that's perfectly tailored to take on a certain FOE. I really enjoyed that.
Yep. Yeah, and I think that it was a little tricky at the beginning because circa 2007, I think a lot of fans of classical Japanese RPGs were more in the Final Fantasy IV tradition where they were used to having pre-generated characters and they had a basic idea of how everything was supposed to work, whereas Entry and Odyssey is just, well, here is a list of archetypes and you can choose from them. We're not going to really give you a ton of direction. You'll just have to kind of suss it out for yourself, put them into a party, mix it up. Name them.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, I don't want to pick on anyone, but Game Informer's sort of infamous review of the first game became sort of emblematic of people who expected RPGs to mean one thing and didn't really get what this game was about and about sort of, you know, the heritage it spoke to. And so, you know, Game Informer, their review was just like, this game is tedious, there's no story, and all your characters do is fight. And so I just named my characters Fight and Heal because that's all they do. So they took a lot of heat for that from fans, and that kind of became a joke. And when the second game came around, they were kinder to it and gave it a more balanced perspective. But, you know, it was kind of a steep request for people who had been accustomed to Final Fantasy or, you know, Tales of whatever to jump into this deep, chewy dungeon RPG when the genre had almost completely vanished in the U.S.
Now, I remember making fun of that review too, and I really wish I hadn't, because I didn't come from an empathic perspective that, oh, you know, this person who played it may not have had the background that other people have had. And when it comes to naming based on your class, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that if that helps you remember, especially when you're having a roster of 9 to 10 different characters that you're cycling in and out.
I'm going to be judgy. I think that if you're a professional, you should kind of know like the background of the game that you're reviewing. It came from kind of a wrong-headed and ill-informed. I'm not going to like go after a review that came out like 10 years ago. It's like whatever. But it does speak to the perspective of people that had at that time, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I've written my share of reviews that were maybe ill-informed or wrong-headed myself, so I can't point fingers. But it does behoove a professional to stop and say, is this game really, you know, what is this about? But, you know, if you don't have the background, you don't have the background, and you may not know that, hey, there is like this entire legacy of games like this. So,
and
you
that's
know,
the other
happens,
thing is
happens.
You think of it, oh, it's a JRPG. And what are JRPGs but story-focused? Mm. Like, so story-focused. And to this day, I know a lot of people who nominally would maybe like this kind of game are going, oh, it doesn't really have a story, right? And that was a big reason that Etrian Odyssey Untold ultimately happened. It's a big reason that the Persona Q games ultimately happened, was because people were like, well, but I want like a more straightforward story. It's like, well, Etrian Odyssey has a story. Like, you eventually discover that there is a narrative to this whole dungeon and everything. It's like, yeah, but it's not a story.
Right. Yeah, they want more dialogue and that sort of thing. And that's fine.